One of the most noticeable quality of a good human being is their generosity. And why is that recognized universally as just an extraordinary thing to do? In part, it's because the generous person is willing to give something of themselves to another without any expectation of a return. Less than that, it's not really generosity. It's kind of a trade, it's a barter, it's meeting expectations. There's all kinds of similarities to generosity. But true generosity is just, I have something that I want to give to you. And how we do that is only possible if we have no attachment to what we're giving. If we have any attachment to what we give, well, there's not real giving there. There's some kind of a, you know, giving but keeping a hold of. And just the very act of disentangling from our possessions, or the very act of lifting our attachment off of what we own or what we consider of value or what we appreciate, is difficult to do. We get very identified with our stuff. We get very identified with owning, having, possessing. And it's often difficult to give. It's easy to give, you know, your old worn-out coat. And that is a kind of giving, because we do let it go. But we didn't have much attachment to it in the first place. But when we give something of value to another who recognizes its value, then we recognize, oh, this act of generosity has, you know, is really more significant in the heart. It makes a greater impact in the heart. So I want to speak about generosity, because I think all of us know the benefit of generosity, even if we don't practice it as much as we could or should or would like to. We still know that if you want to be happy, if I want to be happy, give somebody something. Give a dog a bone. You want to be happy? Give a dog a bone. That dog is so happy, you will have sympathetic joy for that dog. And that's how easy it is, you know, let alone give something of greater value to someone, to someone who needs it more or appreciates it. It just multiplies, you know, exponentially the happiness and joy that's possible for us from practicing and living life generously. And it's not a secret. And yet our conditioning, our cultural conditioning, is very strongly to get, you know, to pursue, to acquire, to consume, to hold on to things long after you have no more use for them. You know, what do you think all these storage sheds are, you know, that people have in those, all these storage sheds that you see around the world? They have stuff that they no longer need or are not using often enough to justify having it in their sight. Well, when we practice generosity, it's doing an inventory, really, of our life and saying, what can I do without? Or it's doing a survey of the world around us and saying, what is the need? What does this person need? What does this village need? What does this country need? What does this organization need? And it's easy to see. If you look, if you ask that question, you see a tremendous amount of need. And the amazing thing is, we have an overabundance of stuff to give. You know, both material things and finances that we can share. Time, knowledge, and love, if you wish. They're all in short supply everywhere. And so for us who wish to be happy, for us who wish to really realize or manifest the greatness that is a potential within us, generosity is a very effective way to do that. Think about it. When someone gives you something, what are you getting? Well, you get the thing, and it can be a code, it can be a dollar, it can be a scholarship, it can be whatever they give. But really, you're getting the recognition from that person that they care about you. They care enough about you to give you something of value to them, of value to you, or that you need. They want you to be happy. They want you to have some of your needs met, whatever that need is, and they want you to be happy. That is the expression of love. And it's difficult to look love in the face and say, I don't need that. That's not important to me. Because we all thrive on that kind of recognition, that kind of acknowledgement, that kind of relationship with others. And the true gift has no strings. It's not like, I'll give you this if you give me that. I'll give you a birthday gift if you give me one back on my birthday. That's kind of cultivating expectation. Or, you know, there's businessmen's giving, which is kind of like, well, it's a responsibility of my role in the organization or my role in society to offer gifts. And so we do. But knowing that there are others in society and the organization that also have their obligation or expectation that they will give in return. This is not real generosity. This is something else. But the generosity that I'm speaking about that really touches the heart and that comes from the heart and that touches the heart is working with your own mind, working with the mind that sees the need, recognizes the need, and takes the opportunity to plant a seed of happiness in your own heart and in the heart of others. Because as we think about practicing generosity or being generous to someone, just thinking about it, we think, we imagine in our mind, oh, I'm going to give them this, you know, and then we get excited about that. And imagining they're receiving it, we get excited about that. And so just even thinking about being generous makes you happy, makes you joyful. And it takes a lot of energy sometimes to acquire what it is you want to give, to set up the arrangement, the time, the place, and to let them know that you're going to offer them something. It takes a lot of mental energy to do that. And all of that mental energy is karma. Planting seeds of happiness. Every moment is happiness, and planting seeds of happiness. Even if, something happens and you're not able to give, you still got all that happiness in planning it. But if you follow through, and when you're actually with the person that you wish to offer something to, you have this thing you wish to offer to them, you see them, you know, and they're there to receive it. And you see their expression on their face, you see their happiness, and while you're offering, it's very sensorially impactful. You see, you hear, you appreciate, you feel their heart. It just makes a tremendous impression on the mind. Impossible to get that out of the mind. Impossible. That's why it's important in practicing generosity to, or in offering something, if possible, to do it face to face, to do it personally, to do it with your own hand, and to offer something of value, because, you know, after all, it's an expression of your love for them, your care for them, your recognition of them. And if you give something that's of minimal or questionable value, well, it's hard to feel good about that. It's good, but if it was something of value that they could really appreciate, then it's more cause for happiness. In your mind, in their mind. After you've performed this act, or after you've practiced generosity, or after you've been generous, every time you think of it, you think, you remember, oh, that was good. You know? And it brings that happiness back. Practicing generosity is like planting, you know, happiness bombs in your mind. Every time you think of it, it comes up. You know, the happiness comes back. Think of it again, happiness comes back. If you want to be happy, give someone something. And every time you remember it, you get to experience that happiness over again. I'm not making this up. You know, I have no self-interest in this. I mean, I see this is the way it works. It really does. And the more skillful we are in practicing generosity, the more happiness and the more enduring that happiness is. Last night I was speaking about, I think it was the homeless people, or, you know, practicing generosity with homeless people, or panhandlers on the street. And as I've mentioned before, and maybe some of you have heard on the podcast that I've heard are going around, lately I have, the last couple of years, I've started engaging with, you know, and really connecting with street people and panhandlers, partly out of my own fear and my own, you know, kind of like judgment and my own, you know, kind of like I'd rather avoid them, and I'm a little bit naive, and I'm a little bit sometimes very afraid of them, and you know, it just was very uncomfortable walking past them on the street. And I realized I'm suffering with this fear, with this anxiety, with this isolation, and I don't know them, and I have these judgments. All that's my suffering, you know, and I didn't want to suffer like that anymore. So I started, you know, at first, kind of, I don't know if this is traditional, just kind of anonymously just give them something and walk on. But that wasn't very satisfying. It's like, yeah, well, I was practicing generosity, but it's kind of like I was kind of not really there for it, didn't really bring any awareness to it. Still, there was some benefit to me, and there was some benefit to them. But then when I stopped, and connected with them and really talked to them, like, how's it going today? You know, you think, well, it must be really difficult to be a panhandler on the street all day. Almost none of them say terrible. You know, they got something good to say about the day. You know, whatever it is, often. And it's such an unexpected response. My projections of how they were feeling, wrong. Huh, that was an eye-opener. I got into asking him, what do you need? You know, like, how much do you need? And the first person I asked, oh, how much do you need? He says, oh, I need $2 to do my laundry. I said, well, that's good. Where can you do your laundry for $2? But anyway, so I pulled out the wallet to get the $2. And he saw that I had more than $2. He said, oh, how about 20? I said, doesn't take $20 to do the laundry. But anyway, so I gave him the $2. And subsequently, you know, there are, well, everyone I asked the question of, there's a story. And it's just really fascinating. What I discovered in my interest to overcome my own suffering, fear, isolation, alienation, is it makes me happy. It makes them happy. To have the recognition that somebody sees them, somebody acknowledges them, somebody's not, you know, standing in judgment, not trying to fix them, not trying to blame them, not trying to, you know, get them off the street. It's just totally accepting. This is the way it is for you. How's it going? And here's some support. Feels great. You know, you walk down the street, instead of feeling like, it's kind of like walk to the other side of the street, I don't want to have to deal with it. You feel happy to walk down that street. I don't go looking for them, but they're always there. There's always someone around that can be, that I can connect with that way, and as a result of that connection, feel happy. But there is a lingering doubt in my mind sometimes that they use what I give them for their own benefit. You know, some of them are obviously drinking, some of them are using drugs, some of them are gosh knows what. And there is this thought in my mind, maybe I'm not really helping them that much. Yeah, they get a hit of happiness, but in the long run, I'm supporting, you know, some unwholesome mind states or unwholesome lifestyle. It doesn't take away from the happiness of the immediacy of the giving, but it has encouraged me to look for other ways, other forms, other opportunities to practice generosity where there isn't that doubt about the benefit. Of course, I teach as I do and go around to different centers, and I see a lot of students that would like to practice or would like to do retreats that don't have funds, don't have the resources. And so, as a way of supporting what I know to be really helpful, skillful, beneficial practice, I and my wife have established or support scholarship funds wherever we teach, because it's all good. It's great to be able to give. It's great that students are able to practice the Dharma or get support to practice the Dharma. And I often say in even situations like this or retreats like this, if any one of you, and this is an invitation, if any one of you would really like to do a retreat and you don't have the resources, let me know. And people do. People say, yeah, I really want to do a retreat and I don't have any funds. And it brings me, us, my wife and I both, just tremendous joy to be able to offer, to know that there's a need and to offer it, knowing that the benefit of the Dharma is worth far more than whatever it is that we offer them in a scholarship. The value of the gift is important, but not the most important. I'll tell you a story. Years ago, I was living in Western Massachusetts, and I saw a newspaper article about a potter nearby where I lived who trained in Japan and had a workshop and a studio nearby. And he had built a traditional Japanese tea house. And he every summer he would bring someone from Japan to offer the tea ceremony a couple times a day. And it was open to the public and it was free. So I said, well, I don't know anything about pottery or tea ceremony. I like tea. So I went. Of course, Japanese tea ceremony is kind of a formal thing, and got educated, and while there I walked around his beautiful grounds and lovely pottery and an interesting tea ceremony. Tea is kind of not my favorite, but anyway, it was, I appreciated it, and it was all offered freely. So at the end of the day, looking around, I realized I couldn't afford any pottery. I was pretty poor at the time. So but at that time, I used to bake bread. I used to make my own bread every week. On the weekend, I would make 6 loaves of bread. And I figured, well, I'll give the potter a loaf of bread. I mean, I didn't have anything else to give him. So I brought him back a loaf of bread and thanked him for having the tea ceremony and the beautiful grounds. And okay. So he used to fire his pottery in a wood-fired kiln. And the wood-fired kiln takes, it took 36 hours or so to heat it up to temperature, keep it at the temperature, let it cool down, and then a day or two later you could empty it because it would be cooled off enough and you could take it out. So he always needed help when he fired his kiln. So he asked me if I'd help him fire his kiln one time, and so he got it started, and he'd been doing it for a few hours. And then he was going to go to bed, get some sleep, and he wanted me to keep it going during the night. So, you know, from 9 o'clock at night till 6 in the morning, I was just throwing sticks in the wood kiln, keep it going, monitoring the temperature and getting it up to where it's going. He came out in the morning and then and finished it off later in the day. For doing that, he invited me back to unload the kiln, and he would let me pick a piece from the firing that I for myself. I thought, that's great. So I went back, helped him unload. He picked out all the tens that were museum quality. He wouldn't let me pick those. He picked those, set those aside, and said, anything else, take your pick. So I looked around, and I found a bowl that you could eat out of, eating out of size. And it became my number one attachment. I was really attached to that bowl. So I used to take it with me on every retreat that I went. I was doing a lot of retreats at the time. And I would take it and I would use it in all the retreats. So I invested a lot of energy and a lot of attachment to that bowl. And it was just an ordinary bowl, but it was nice. It was just the right size. Later I went off to Asia, ordained. 5 years later came back. And out of appreciation for my Dharma teachers sharing the Dharma with me or inviting me to the Dharma, I wanted to offer my teachers something. So I looked through everything I had, and the thing of greatest value was that bowl. So I said, boy, I really love this bowl. It's been so meaningful in my life. So I offered it as a gift to one of my teachers who had just had a new house built, and I offered them this gift. And they, in turn, appreciated it to the extent that they put it on their mantle over their fireplace, you know, another thing. And I would see it there when I would go to their house. And I'd see, oh, there's that bowl. That's nice. You know, it's like it made me happy to receive the bowl from the potter. And then it made me happy to use it. And then it made me happy to be able to offer it. And then it made me happy to see it on my teacher's mantle. Years went by. I lost track of it. At some point, after I'd been teaching for a number of years, a woman who was a great supporter of the Dharma invited me to her house. She wanted to talk to me about, you know, supporting some of what we're doing. So I said, okay. So I went to her house in Cambridge, and she lived very simply, and her house was pretty empty. We started the dinner on the patio outside, and then as it got the sunset, we went inside, and in her kind of living room, dining room area, there was nothing. It was like a plant over here, and over there in one end of the living room was a little two-person couch with a little coffee table in front of it and a one-person chair on the other side, and that was about it. There was a little Buddha on the windowsill, you know, like one-inch Buddha. And that was it. There was just nothing in the place. So we went in, and I sat down, and she sat down, and I looked on the coffee table. There was that bowl. So I said to her, I said, oh, that's a really nice bowl you got there. And she says, yes. And I said, you know the story of that bowl? And she says, well, it was given to me by one of my teachers. And I said, I thought probably it was. And at first I had a twinge of like, oh, My teacher didn't like it. They gave it away. And then I realized, no, we give things that we appreciate, that we like, that are of value to us, that we think someone else would like. So I told this woman the story of how that bowl happened to get there. And in telling it, I realized that it was that bowl and the giving of it from the potter to me, from me to my teacher to their supporter. The value of the happiness is immense, and the value of the bowl is insignificant. It's in the giving and the receiving of it that all the happiness comes. And that's what's so magical about generosity. It's really the mind behind the generosity that causes the happiness. Oh yeah, it's good to get the bowl, but that's not really what we're trading here. That's really not what we're giving. And that's the way generosity works. It's really developing the mind of non-attachment and the joy, love, connection, appreciation, gratitude that is apparent in the offering. So we offer what we do to others that have a need, and we feel happy. Is that it? Well, if you look around the world, and your world could be the south side of Seattle, or it could be Southeast Asia, doesn't matter, whatever your world is, you look around the world, there's just tremendous need, immense need everywhere you look. And it's easy to feel overwhelmed, to just say, the problem of the homeless, or the problem of, you know, uneducated kids is just immense. It's just overwhelming. And, you know, it's a problem that's, well, certainly not going to be solved by my donation or my act of generosity. And yet, even when you make a gesture to one person or to one village or to one, it has an effect. And it has a rippling effect that goes out into society, it goes out into the village, it goes out into the family, wherever it goes. And it just has a tremendous magnifying effect. Several years ago now, a friend came to me and said, you know any nonprofits that support education in third world countries? I said, no. And, you know, he said, do you support it? I said, no. He said, well, okay. But I said, I'll keep my eyes open. If I hear of anything, I'll let you know. It wasn't a week later, one of my teachers, former teachers from Burma, a monk, kind of put out the word that he'd like to build a school in his native village. So I thought, he wants to build a school in his native village, and this guy wants to support education in third world countries. Maybe it'll fit. So I talked to both of them about the possibility, and after a little communication, it was decided that my friend would donate the money to build a school. So I said, okay, how much is the school? $20,000 for a six-room school in central Burma. I said, great. I took the first $5,000, went off to Burma, gave it to the Sayadaw, the elder, the monk, and he said, oh, costs have gone up. It's actually $40,000. I said, oh, well, I only have a pledge for $20,000. So I said, I'll go back and see, you know, what I can do. And so I came back, spoke to my friend, and he said, sure. Sure, why not? You know, I mean, so sent the money over. And after, you know, or as it was being built, or after it was built, I asked my friend, I said, would you like to go see your school? He said, no. He says, you know, it's like, you know, it takes a couple $1,000s to go over there, and I might as well just send the money, and why, you know, but once it was built, I said, well, I'm going to Burma, and I'm going to go see the school, and I was going to practice with one of my teacher friends there, and Utejaniya, and my friend said, oh, okay, I'll go. And I said, well, if we're going to go to Burma to go look at the school, you ought to plan on sitting in the monastery for a while, like 3 weeks, which is not what he expected. But nevertheless, he said, okay. So we went to see the school. Now, you know, usually when you make an offering like that, I mean, school is a pretty big thing, you know, but for $40,000, you could buy a toilet in a school in Seattle. But over there, you build a school for 600 kids, or 300 kids, sorry. So that we were picked up at the airport in Mandalay, and somehow I expected, we had hoped, I guess, that it would be comfortable. It wasn't. The car we were picked up in must have been 25 years old, bald tires, no shocks, no air conditioner, ratty interior, and we were going like 4 or 5 hours on roads that, we wouldn't even call them oxcart tracks. Nevertheless, we eventually got there. And when we got there at the school, all of the kids, 600 kids, were lined up, all the girls on one side, all the boys on the other, and most of the village was there, forming kind of a walkway that we walked through. You know, they were 10 feet apart, and we had to walk from the car through past all of them to get to the school. Unbelievable. You cannot imagine what that does to your heart. You can't imagine. And then we looked at what they had been using for a school. Thatch roof pole shed, you know, for a few months of the year when it wasn't raining. Other than that, they couldn't go to school. Now they've got a two-story, six-room cement school, glass windows, and the rippling effect in that village is immense. Now the girls can go to school. Before, it's only boys who go to school because it's kind of a rough school. Now the girls can go to school. And the effect on the whole village is generational. Sometimes when we make offerings, when we practice generosity, there's an immediate benefit for one person, obvious. But sometimes we plant seeds that have tremendous effect, much greater effect, touching more people for much longer periods of time. So over the course of the intervening years, he and I and other supporter have been building a lot of schools, you know, 10 or 15 a year for a few years now. And we go back every year to visit these villages, and we built some nunneries and some a clinic and schools and repaired a lot of schools. And in every place, it's the same thing. It's just, it transforms the village in a way that, well, we can't even really appreciate. I mean, we don't see how it does, but it does. But, you know, even with all of that and the tremendous good feeling that comes from that, it's a challenge. It's really a challenge to, you know, keep people honest and get the right price and not be taken advantage of and make sure the kids go to school and, you know, make sure the teachers are paid. And there's some niggling stuff that just kind of lingers, like, isn't there some way to do this a little better? Isn't there some way to see that more of the kids go to school? And so while there's a lot of happiness and there's a lot of joy in that, there still is room for improvement in our giving, in how we give. And I mean, we're just letting them have it, and we're not holding back. But still, we'd like to see, you know, our funds used the way that we intended. You know, we have some attachment to how our gift is received. So, one more story about generosity. Where I live on Maui is on a hillside that's all ranch land. And when the ranchers came and brought the cows to Maui, they cut all the trees. They cut all the trees on this side of the mountain so that they could have pasture land. Well, when this side of the mountain was forested, it rained every day. Clouds formed, and it rained every day. And the clouds were so big that they would spread out over the ocean and they would go out over one of the other islands, Kaho'olawe, that wasn't high enough to form its own clouds. But because they got the clouds from Maui every day, it rained on Kaho'olawe every day. So it also was forested. When they cut the trees on Maui and started growing cows, no more clouds, no more rain, no more rain on Kaho'olawe. All the trees died, and all the topsoil blew off the island. Kaho'olawe is now used, or for many years was used as a bombing range for the U.S. Navy. Nothing lived there. So a few years ago, I read one of the Buddha's comments about his life, in which he said, "I resort to the forest for two reasons. I go and spend time in the forest for two reasons. I see a pleasant abiding for myself here and now, and I have compassion for future generations." I don't know what he means. I go to the forest because I have compassion for future generations. But even though I don't know what he means, I'm planting trees. Because I figure planting trees is a gift that everyone will enjoy on the face of this earth. And it's just my act of generosity to just plant trees, knowing that, well, I'm not going to see those trees grow to maturity. You know, some of these trees take 500 years. Sandalwoods take 500 years. I'm not going to see them. But it's something that I'm willing to give those beings who are not yet born. Our practice of the Dharma is like that. When you take your energy and you use it to be aware, to understand the teachings of the Buddha and to practice, to realize for yourself, then you have something to offer the future generation. You have that understanding, you have that realization, you have that commitment. Because there are untold future generations that will need these teachings, that will want these teachings. And it's only because we listen, we practice, we realize, and we offer them freely that these teachings and the teachings of awareness and liberation will be available in the future. Just practicing the Dharma is one of the greatest gifts you can give to yourself, to your family, to your community, and to the world. Even though you may not see the result. It is said that the gift of the Dharma is the greatest gift. And this is what it means. If you listen, and you practice, and you realize, and you share, then you're giving the greatest gift that can be given.